Well, I hope you've caught your second wind. You have this evening and tomorrow morning, and you're doing pretty well. I don't see too many of you double parked in the twilight zone out there, so that's a good sign. I've never understood anybody sleeping in my preaching or anything, because I have never yet fallen asleep while I'm preaching, and I never understand why anybody else can do that. But Secret of Perseverance is the next discourse we're going to look at. The title tonight is, in this one, is Why All the Unsolved Mysteries. Discourse 1 was The Secret of Pleasure, 2, The Secret of Providence, 3, The Secret of Prosperity, and now The Secret of Perseverance. How do we stay steady in the midst of all of this stuff that happens in this earth? Notes say in the beginning there, in the introduction, no new arguments here, just more applications of the same. We are back to human limitation and intentional mystery. Nonetheless, mystery is not an occasion for despair, but for dependency. And we have to ask ourselves, how well do I handle mystery when I don't know how something is going to be? How well do we handle unsolved issues? Unsolved mysteries, unresolved problems. Remember some years ago, I sent a call slip to a day student, a call slip in his post office box, and come and see me the next week. I sent it out toward the end of the week, and I assumed he'd get it on Friday and come see my secretary and find out a time when we could talk. And it wasn't anything could be handled over the phone or anything. I really needed to talk with him face to face. I didn't want to give him an opportunity to lie to me, but it's easier to do that over the phone than it is eyeball to eyeball. And he was already going to be in enough trouble, and I didn't want him to add anything to that, and I really wanted to see him face to face. And so I sent him the call slip to come see me. Well, Friday night, I got a very frantic call from his mother and saying, my son got a note from me today to come and see you next week. And I said, yes, I'd like to talk to him sometime Monday or Tuesday. And she said, can he see you this weekend? And I said, no, he really can't. I'm committed on other things, and if something can wait, he can see me Monday morning and see my secretary Monday. And she said, you mean he might not even see you right away Monday morning? And I said, well, probably he won't, but he needs to see my secretary and find out when he can. And she said, Can you tell me what this is about? And I said, no, ma'am, I really can't. I'm not trying to be difficult here, but it's something I really want to talk with him face to face about. And she said, but can't you give me a little clue about what this is about? She said, this is, you mean we got to wait till Monday or Tuesday to find out what this is about? And I said, yes, ma'am, I really want to talk with him personally, and I probably won't get to see him until Monday or Tuesday. She said, well, I won't be able to sleep until I know what this is. And I said, well, ma'am, it's probably going to be a really long weekend then for you, but I'm sorry. But he's going to have to come in Monday or Tuesday, or it's Monday, and see if he can see me Monday or Tuesday. But I want to talk with him face to face. Well, here's a mom who doesn't handle unresolved mysteries very well. If it's something, obviously, if it's something exceedingly urgent, I would see him, and I don't just intentionally try to string people out or anything and, you know, make it worse. But it was in the whole scheme of things, it was something could be handled the first part of the week, and it was going to be a long weekend. But here was a mother obsessed with trying to know what's going on. Now, I can understand a genuine concern of a mother, especially if her son is kind of always on the edge anyway and so forth. But sometimes, you know, for us to say, well, I won't sleep all weekend if I don't know this, is a sad testimony about our own Christian walk. What do children do when they can't get the answer to a homework problem? What are some of the things? Help me out here a little bit. We don't have microphones, so you have to speak very loudly. But if you have a child, none of us did this when we were children, but maybe the children in our house do this. If you can't get an answer to a problem, what are some of the things a child might do? Raise your hand so I can see where you're coming from and where you are. And what? Yes, sir. Yeah, you write a question mark on it and skip it. I was wanting to think about that one. That's one thing. What are some other things a kid might do? Yes, ma'am. Okay, call a friend or a classmate. call the parents. There's some other things they can do. Make one up, yeah. There we go. Well, all kinds of things they can do. I want to give you some here that I've thought of. One thing, if you're trying to work out this problem, and I'm thinking about a particular situation that happened in our house and during the elementary school years of one of our daughters, and it was early high school, and there was a particular thing she just couldn't get, and it was very irritating to her that she couldn't get it. And the first thing, and this was kind of a surprising reaction, this wasn't the normal thing, but it was obviously exposed some things that gave us a chance to talk with her. And the first thing she did was attack the teacher. They shouldn't be giving us problems this hard. Don't they know I'm only in ninth grade? I haven't written all kinds of papers before and all this kind of thing. And all this, it's attack the teacher. Unfair, unclear, uncaring, all of those kinds of things. The second thing can be to attack the subject. I remember when Kirsten was when she was in first grade. She and I in our family are mathematically challenged, and she had a real rough time with math. And I do better at verbal kinds of things, sitting down and doing. I pretty much, as I told you, I can do all right with a four function calculator, but anything beyond that kind of gets beyond me. But I was sitting at the kitchen table and I was working on something and she was working on something and she was doing her math and she kind of just threw her pencil down and she, first grade, she said, "Who needs numbers anyway?" And I said, so this is attacking the subject, and I said, "Well, what do you want to be when you grow up?" She said, "I just want to be a mom." And I said, "Okay, come on over here to the counter." And I took out one of the recipes out of the recipe box of her mom's, and I laid it down on the counter, and I handed it to her, and I said, "Do you see any numbers on that? Are you going to cook?" She said, "Yes." And I walked over there, and I got that, and I said, "Do you see any numbers on that?" She said, "Yes." And I said, "And what are you going to buy all this food with that you're going to cook with?" And she said, "Checkbook." And I pulled a checkbook out of my pocket and I showed her the register and I said, "Do you see any numbers on this?" And she said, "Yes." We do need numbers. We can attack the teacher. We can attack the subject. We can avoid the problem. I think I'm sick today, Mommy. And I don't think I can go to school. I tell you, when I was a day student, I don't remember giving in to this. I may have. I don't remember it. The Lord hasn't convicted me about it if I did, and I don't remember that I did. But, when I was a day student and I didn't have my Greek done, there were a lot of mornings I woke up not feeling very well. And you can avoid the problem. I don't remember skipping school, but I don't think I did. But you can avoid the problem, or you can ask for help. Call a friend or ask the parent or whatever. Well, sometimes in life, we handle mystery that same way. We attack the teacher, we attack God. "This isn't fair. You let this happen to me. There's too much here. This is more than I can..." "Don't you know I'm only in ninth grade, God? I don't have a seminary degree. How do you think I can handle this?" We attack the teacher or we attack the subject. Christian growth. Right. Sanctification. Right. Who needs it? Or we can avoid it altogether. We just don't read our Bible. We don't talk to God. We avoid it altogether. Or we can ask for help. When we get in over our head in something, that's not a time to give up. That's time to ask for help. Both from other people who can help us with the subject and with the teacher himself asking help. We have a thing in our culture where we say, real men don't ask directions. Real men, real wise men, really do. We say, "Well, it's just a male ego." I wish we could deal away with that word. It's just pride. It's just stinking pride. I mean, we're already lost, and we don't want to admit it, and we have no idea where we're going. So we're just going to, once we have lost sight of our goal, just redouble our effort. And we can do that with spiritual things too. We're too proud and too dependent. And that will be our ruin. Well, chapter 9 that we're coming to in Ecclesiastes is designed to blast away any vestiges of hope that we could We could have life figured out and control it on our own. Patty has a saying that is really apropos here. When there are things that you do not know about your life, then you must focus on the things you do know about God. When there's mystery in your life, then you have to redouble your focus on what you do know about your God. And that brings us to point A, unsolved mysteries, some goads here in chapter 9. Again, these force us to find our hope outside of our experience. And mystery number one that he's going to goad us with is, why does God seem so unpredictable? Verse 1, chapter 9, "For all this I considered in my heart, even to declare all this, that the righteous and the wise and their works are in the hand of God, and no man knoweth either love or hatred by all that is before them." And he's saying, you know what? If I look at the circumstances of my life, I feel like I'm pulling petals off a flower and saying, he loves me, he loves me not. He loves me, he loves me not. He loves me, he loves me not. The car broke down, he doesn't love me. He answered this prayer, he loves me. My wife didn't do this, he loves me not. And back and forth we go with the circumstances of life, trying to determine whether God loves us or not by that. It's kind of like the fatalism of Omar Khayyam, Hindu writer. As it says in your notes, he reflects the only possibility if there is no personal God. In his dismal view, we are but helpless pieces of a game he plays upon this checkerboard of nights and days. Hither and thither moves and checks and slays, and one by one back in the closet lays. Now, if you don't have a personal loving God, that is the only other option. And you feel like you're some kind of pawn. But God is always acting consistently with his purpose for us, and that is Christ's likeness. Always. God is predictable. He is going to work Christ's likeness in us through these circumstances. Or he's going to give us opportunities for that. God is predictable. We don't have to wonder if we're in the hands of friend or foe. And the first question he poses is, why does God seem so unpredictable? Question number two, why does death seem so unpredictable? Verses 2-6. "All things come alike to all. There is one event," talking about death here, "to the righteous and to the wicked, to the good and to the clean and to the unclean. To him that sacrificeth," or is reverent and respectful in his vows, "and to him that sacrificeth not. As is the good, so is the sinner. And he that sweareth," talking about allegiance to a covenant there, it's not talking about profanity, "as he that feareth an oath," or shuns an oath. "This is an evil among all things that are done under the sun, that there is one event unto all, yea, also the heart of the sons of men is full of evil, and madness is in their heart while they live, and after that they go to the dead. For to him that is joined to all the living, there is hope, for a living dog is better than a dead lion." That's a good proverb. Put that one above your kitchen, your dining room table. Just have that calligraphied and put up there. "A living dog is better than a dead lion." That would be exciting dinner time talk. Verse 5. "For the living know that they shall die, but the dead know not anything, neither have they any more a reward, for the memory of them is forgotten. Also their love and their hatred and their envy is now perished. Neither have they any more a portion forever in anything that is done under the sun." What he's describing here is a goad of death. Death is an enormous leveler. Everybody turns out the same in the end as far as dying is concerned. And he says in verse 3, "This is outrageous. All die, and while they live, they destroy each other." And he is in verse 3 when he says, "Also the heart of the sons of men is full of evil, and madness is in their heart while they live." Boy, if that isn't a commentary on humanity. Destroying each other while we live. And you look at our culture and the unrestrained hearts of people today cost society enormous amounts of money. I tell you one thing that really goads me. You know, I'm grieved for every serviceman that is killed over there in Iraq. But I tell you what even grieves me more is that 18,000 a year die by alcohol-related deaths on the highways. And we don't do anything about it. All these people will get on the news and scream about these 50 people that have died. And that is a tragedy since the war is over. And I'm not minimizing that either. But we're straining at that gnat while we swallow camels by the tens of thousands. And then talk about abortion on top of that. We are a destructive society. As it says in your notes, even if you win the rat race, you're still a rat, he's saying. And you're probably too tired to eat the cheese. Okay, so you win the rat race. You're still a rat and you're too tired to eat the cheese. Yes, death hits us all. These are in your notes. But while you live, there is hope. You only go around once, so you'd better go around right. That's an important. It's not that you only go around once, so you better live it up. No, you only do this once in life. You better do it right in life. The brevity of life is a spur to enjoy the gifts and the labor of the giver. Put death to shame by how you live. I'm going to come back to that. Put death to shame by how you live. The world, for the most part, derives contentment from things, whereas Christians bring contentment to things. And then he's going to talk about contentment here, what kind of responsibility we ought to have in view of death, that life is short and that it's a great leveler and everybody is going to be going back to dust. And he says there's several things ought to embody your life. In light of this death, verse 7, go thy way, eat thy bread with joy, and drink thy wine with a merry heart, for God now accepteth thy works. He's not saying here, eat and drink and party. You know, we might look at that and say, well, that's talking about partying. That's a phrase that means enjoy with contentedness what God has given you now. Death is coming. Enjoy what you have. It's a call to contentment. Eat your food. It's a gift from God, he's saying. Secondly, celebration. Verse 8, let thy garments be always white, and let thy head lack no ointment. White garments were reserved by the common folk for special celebrations, weddings and things like that. The rich had white garments for just about anything they wanted to do. And he's saying here, let thy garments be always white, and let thy head lack no ointment. Because God is working in us and God is moving among us, we can have a constant source of celebration in our soul because of what God is doing in us. So he's saying, enjoy your food, the celebration, enjoy the fellowship that God has given you with other people. I guess we could say, enjoy your food, enjoy your friends, the celebration with your friends. We ought to be rejoicing with one another. It says, enjoy your friends, their gift of God. Verse 9, live joyfully with the wife whom thou lovest all the days. This is enjoy your family. Live joyfully with the wife whom thou lovest all the days of the life of thy vanity, which he hath given thee under the sun, all the days of thy vanity. For that is thy portion in this life, and in thy labor which thou takest under the sun. He's saying, enjoy your food, be content with it, and be joyful in life. Enjoy the companionship, the celebrations that you can have with other people. Enjoy your family. Don't always be looking for something else to make you happy. It's all right here with a heart that's content with God. And beyond that, he says, put some commitment into your life. Work hard. Verse 10, whatsoever thy hand findeth to do, do it with thy might. For there is no work, nor device, nor knowledge, nor wisdom in the grave whither thou goest. Now, folks, that's really good advice. He's just saying, you know, how we would say to our kids when they were young, and they'd say, Daddy, I'm bored, I want this and that. We'd say, play with the toys you have, you know. And we'd have to go help them play with them and find some enjoyment in them and this kind of thing. And God is saying, look, enjoy what I've given you. Enjoy the food, the companionship, the family, everything that I've given you. Enjoy that. Don't be looking for more. Death is coming. Time is short. Enjoy what I've given you. And by the way, folks, this is the way we put death to shame. I hadn't thought much about death till I got older, and not that I was thinking I was going to die at any moment, but I But the older you get, the more people you know die. And I think of some people when I think back. People who died who, in my opinion, put death to shame. I think about Dr. Bob Jr. when he died. Death didn't have anything on him. He lived joyfully in this life, laboring, working hard. And when he died, Satan couldn't walk away with the victory on that. He put death to shame. I think of Roland Cornelius. He put death to shame. I think of Steve Forsythe. Steve put death to shame. I think of Dal Washer. He put death to shame. I think of Chuck Joss. Chuck put death to shame. Would that be the testimony of our lives? That when we die, we wouldn't say, oh my, what a shame he wasted his life. Or will we be able to put death to shame by the way we have lived joyfully in all of the circumstances God has given us in this life, and being content with what he's given us here? I remember the first time death really hit me hard was my freshman year. I came to college at Bob Jones to do my 1 year time, as I said earlier, in that maximum security facility. And then I was going to go home and do what I wanted to do with my life. And God began turning my heart around, and by the end of my freshman year, I really was headed a different path. There were a lot of things that had to be cleaned out, but I was going a different direction. Still had some baggage I was towing along, but I began to be concerned about what I was going to do with my life. I came to Bob Jones, and I had no idea what to major in, And you know, I didn't care because I wasn't going to be here anyway. I was just going to do my time, and then when I got out, I was going to go do what I wanted. And so I didn't care, but then I got right with God, and I started to be concerned about what am I going to major in. And you don't have to be, I mean, you don't have to get that really nailed down your freshman year without too much trouble. You probably by the middle of your sophomore year, you ought to get it nailed down, or you'll be, your parents, if they're paying for it, whoever's paying for it, you will be extending your stay, and it will cost more. And I hadn't got it nailed down, and I kept praying, Lord, what do you want me to do? Is it A, B, or C? And it kept coming back, D, none of the above. And I kept thinking, well, God, if you're not going to tell me what I'm going to do when I finish college, how do I know what to major in now? Isn't that a logical question? Shouldn't you be able to know what you want to do down there, what you're going to do, and that would determine what you're going to major in now? And you know, I went through 6 years of college, 4 years of undergrad, and two months short of two years of grad school without a clue of what I was going to do. And I know why now. God wasn't going to tell me two months before I finished grad school, Dr. Bob asked me to begin training for a dean of students position. Well, God wasn't going to tell me that anytime sooner. If you told me my freshman year when I came, there's no way. Dean of students here? I wasn't going to stay here anyway. I was going to split this popcorn stand, you know, as we said back in those days. And the end of my freshman year, I was working at the information desk, and the fellow who was there, who trained me on my shift, I worked with him. He was a senior, and he trained me because we were on the same schedule pretty much. And his name was Chuck Nichols. Chuck was a godly, godly man. I mean, even the reprobates on campus respected Chuck. He was friendly to everybody. He didn't look down on anybody, but when he walked into the room, it was just kind of like you knew that somebody who loved God was there. And he was just a great guy to be along. Sang like a bird. He was on Vespers. He was an athlete. I mean, Chuck just did everything. I had a lot of respect for Chuck. And I spent a lot of time with him because he was training me at the information desk. And then just a month or so before graduation, Chuck and his brother were up in Pierce Mountain, and they decided to swim across the lake. And for some reason, Chuck went under and drowned. And I tell you, that hit me between the eyeballs. And I started thinking, you know, here I am bent out of shape about what I'm going to do in the future when I'm not guaranteed that I have any future. Everything Chuck ever did for God, he did before he got a diploma from Bob Jones University. And I thought, I'm not guaranteed anything better. So I better get busy today. It really doesn't matter what He may not be telling me what I'm going to do in the future, because there may not be a future for me. I may not get out of here alive. This is what hit me, this thought. It wasn't this verse, but this thought. And that is that whithersoever thy hand findeth to do, do it with thy might, for there is no work, nor device, nor knowledge, nor wisdom in the grave whither thou goest. Everything Chuck did for God, he did before he finished Bob Jones University. And I tell you what, I got busy. And God really began plowing deep. I remember right at that same time praying about what I'm going to major in next year. And I was reading Things I Have Learned by Dr. Bob Senior, one of the requirements for freshman orientation. And one of the sermons in there, one of the chapel sermons, was discussing the different chapel sayings of Dr. Bob Senior. One of them was, there was a prepared place for a prepared person. And I thought, that's the answer I've been looking for. It's God's job to figure out what to do with me. It's my job to be the kind of person he can use. There are plenty of opportunities of ministry out there. God has more work to be done than he has qualified people to do it. So it's his job to figure out something to do with me, and he can certainly find something for me to do if I'm the kind of person he can use. And it was Chuck's death that made me begin thinking, I better get my life in order so that God can use me whatever he wants to do. And I majored in Bible because it was just the broadest thing I could ever major in for ministry. I had no idea what I was going to do with it. And I minored in Greek, and I finished the undergrad, and I still didn't know what to do. And so I got a master's in theology, broadest master's I could find, because I didn't know what he was going to do. There wasn't a dean of students major, you know, so it had to be something else God took me through. All I'm saying is, death is this kind of goad. It ought to bring us to this point where we say, you know what? I'm not guaranteed anything. I better enjoy everything God has given me right now and not fuss about what I don't have. And in the meantime, I better start working hard and getting busy so that God can use me today. And that's what Solomon's conclusion is here. Death is a spur to make us live life right. Put death to shame by the way you live. Look at another goad of mysteries. Why do circumstances seem so unpredictable? And a lot of this we've seen before. He just keeps kind of hammering away at it. Verse 11, I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, neither yet bread to the wise, nor yet riches to men of understanding, nor yet favor to men of skill, but time and chance happen to them all. From his standpoint, it looks like it's just roll of the dice. And we look at that and we say, well, you know, if the race is not to the swift and the battle not to the strong and so forth, why should I try? Look, folks, this is great help. This is great hope to us. The race doesn't go to the swift all the time. That ought to encourage most of us, shouldn't it? The battle doesn't go to the strong. That's a blessing. Neither yet bread to the wise, nor riches to men of understanding, nor yet favor to men of skill. He's put this treasure in earthen vessels, hasn't he? That the excellency of the power may be of God and not of us. He's put this glory in plastic freezer containers. I used to say Tupperware, but Tupperware is expensive. That's about like China, you know. You ever hear that thing about a little boy? His mom was leaving one night, and he said to his daddy, Daddy, where's mommy going? And she said, and he said, she's going to a Tupperware party. And he said, Dad, what's a Tupperware party? He said, well, son, that's where women sit around in a circle and sell each other plastic bowls. And the boy looked at his dad, and he said, oh, come on, Dad, what is it really? Folks, that's what it is, really. Really. But here he says in verse 11, it seems so unpredictable. Well, that ought to be a great blessing to us, because the race doesn't always go to the swift and the battle to the strong. It's a great encouragement to me. Verse 12. For man also knoweth not his time of death there, as the fishes that are taken in an evil net, and as the birds that are caught in a snare, so are the sons of men snared in an evil time when it falleth suddenly upon them. Talking about death again. Why do these circumstances seem so unpredictable? Well, remember, if you go back to chapter 3, verse 14, at the end of the discourse number 1, he says, I know that whatsoever God doeth, he doeth it forever. With the eternity in view, nothing can be put to it, nor anything taken from it, and God doeth it that men should fear before him. God does these unpredictable things so that we have to depend. Look at your notes. It says, advantages and assets are not the determinative factors. Success is not automatic for the swift, the strong, the wise, the understanding, the skillful. Time and chance seem to rule. Sometimes we seem like we're fish caught in a net. But remember God's equation of enjoyment. You can pile all those things, all those wins, and all those benefits on your side, but the real factor is God's factor in this. And God is the critical multiplying factor. No matter what the circumstances are, God in the picture multiplies the joy. Mystery number 4, why do people seem so unpredictable? You know, this really, if you're a reflecting person at all, these are questions that we think about. Now, if you don't reflect at all, and this is all new to you, it's time to start reflecting. You need some goads in life. Verse 14, there was a little city. Or verse 13, he says, this wisdom have I seen also under the sun, and it seemed great unto me. There was a little city, and few men within it, and there came a great king against it, and besieged it, and built great bulwarks against it. Now there was found in that little city, a poor wise man, and he, by his wisdom, delivered the city. Yet no man remembered that same poor man. Then said I, wisdom is better than strength. Obviously, the wise man won the war. Nevertheless, the poor man's wisdom is despised, and his words are not heard. The words of the wise men are heard in quiet more than the cry of him that ruleth among fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroyeth much good. Well, people seem very, very unpredictable, but how do we react to all of the unpredictability of people? One, wisdom is better than strength. There may be people that look like they have more strength than we do, they have more power over us than we do, but God says wisdom is better than that. A poor wise man can by his wisdom defeat strength. God has done, if you look at 1 Corinthians 2, that's the whole testimony of that God has chosen the weak things of the world to confound the wise. And they say, well, I'm the only saved person in a very wicked family. That's the way he set it up. I mean, that's how he works best. He says, I've chosen the foolish things to confound the wise. Wisdom is better than strength. One wise man can have much influence. Problem is also, another part of the goad, is wisdom is not always heeded. Verse 17 says, it is heeded by those who quietly reflect, but it's often ignored by the haughty ones in power. And people get hurt then. And he goes on and says, I'm summarizing these verses for you. One wicked man can have much influence. A wise man can have a lot of influence. A wicked man can have much influence. And verse 17 and 18, the last word seems to go to the loudest and to the strongest. So what is our reaction to all of these? All of the unpredictability of death, the unpredictability of people, the unpredictability of circumstances, the seeming unpredictability of God. How do you stay steady in all of this stuff? And then he tells us in chapter 10. And he's going to tell us several ways to persevere in this last sermon. First of all, persevere wisely in this world of mysteries. That's the heading point B. And then he talks about fools. He said, now don't be like these people. You got these are hard things, these circumstances that are up and down, these people that are difficult. God, when He seems to be unpredictable, how do you persevere wisely? By avoiding these kinds of things that fools are. And then he talks about foolishness, and I call this first three verses fools on parade. Point A, their folly starts small. Verse 1, dead flies cause the ointment of the apothecary to send forth a stinking savor. So doth a little folly him that is in reputation for wisdom and honor. Now, what does that mean? Well, back in those days, the apothecary or the perfumer, when he would make the perfume, he would take all the oils, the different kinds of oils and the spices, and mix them together in his little formula to come up with, you know, whatever, you know, Chanel number 5, whatever it is that he's going to have, and call it. And he would put it in a bottle, an alabaster bottle perhaps, or some other kind of bottle. And then put a cap on it, and then sell it to, you know, Mrs. Joseph, you know, when she comes to buy perfume. Now, if he had not cleaned that out real well before he put the perfume in it, and flies had been in there and laid little eggs inside there, microscopic eggs, and then he corked it, and the eggs hatched, and the flies buzzed around inside their very wonderfully smelling tomb, and then, you know, eventually they would die, and so they die and they rot inside, and then when Mrs. Joseph comes and takes the cork off, in this wonderful anniversary moment that her husband has planned, and it smells like dead flies. Now here, what he's saying is, a very small thing can mess up something that's very valuable. Small fly specks can mess up expensive perfume, and so does a little bit of folly mess up a man's reputation and honor. There's a great caution to us here. When you have all these unpredictable things, you better watch your response, because you can blow your whole testimony. Persevere wisely, he's saying. Folly starts small. What Paul said, I keep under my body and bring it into subjection, lest when I have preached to others, I myself should be a castaway, that my own reputation will stink in the end. Folly starts small. Folly starts in the heart. Verse 2, a wise man's heart is at his right hand, or it leads him right. But a fool's heart is at his left hand. It leads him away. Now, unfortunately, in those days, there was, in some circles, a stigma about being left-handed. Now, for all of you Southpaws here, that's not a cultural factor today. But your right hand was a hand of blessing. The left hand was, in some circles, was considered bad. And he says, a wise man's heart is at his right hand, but a fool's heart at his left. But he's saying that folly starts in his heart. And that's why he says over in Proverbs for us to guard our heart, for out of it come all the issues of life. How are you going to respond to all these up and down times? By whatever's in your heart. And folly will start in the heart. It starts small, it starts in the heart, but folly in the heart shows up in the life. Verse 3. Yea, also, when he that is a fool walketh by the way, his wisdom faileth him. He doesn't know how to handle life. And he says to everyone that he is a fool. By the way he handles his problems, he advertises his foolishness. Now remember, in Scripture, foolishness isn't talking about just being a little bit rowdy. Well, would you boys catch your foolishness out and settle down. That's not what they're talking about. Foolishness means a person who has a life view absent, without God present in his thoughts. And Solomon is saying, by the way you handle the problems of life, you reveal to everyone that you don't have God in a focus. Persevere in all of these ups and downs wisely, not as a fool here. Notice in your notes here, this quote from Kidner. The fool has no way of disguising what he is except perhaps by total silence. Even then his general bearing would probably give him away. But in fact, he is too full of himself to refrain from airing his views to everyone he meets. To judge from Proverbs, his fine phrases will sound incongruous. Excellent speech becometh not a fool, it says in Proverbs 17:7. His tactless remarks impertinent, and when you talk to him, he is not really listening. If he has a message for you, he will get it wrong. And if he comes out with a sage remark, it will misfire. You can fortunately sense his approach by the efforts of all and sundry to slip away. In other words, people don't want to be around him. It's like you drive up to the restaurant, 6 o'clock at night, restaurants ought to be packed, and you drive up to this one restaurant, and it's 6 o'clock dinner hour, and there are only 2 cars in the parking lot. And you wonder, why don't people come to this restaurant? And if I knew what they knew, would I be here too? You know? and you know a fool because people aren't following him. The right people aren't following him. He talks about, that was fools on parade, this I call fools in high places. Governing fools. Verses 4 to 7, if the spirit of the ruler rise up against thee, he's talking about now how to persevere wisely in all these fluctuations. If the spirit of a ruler rise up against thee, leave not thy place, for yielding peace pacifieth great offenses. What is he saying here? He's saying don't leave in a huff. If your leader, your boss, tells you something to do and you don't like it, don't stomp your foot, snort, and turn around and leave. That shows you are a fool. You're not persevering wisely in those fluctuations. Verse 5, there is an evil which I have seen under the sun as an error which proceedeth from the ruler. Folly is set in great dignity. Oftentimes the fool gets put on the throne. And the rich, the one who really has wisdom, sits in a low place. I have seen servants upon horses and princes walking as servants upon the earth. They say sometimes even a foolish king puts the wrong people in office. Foolish rulers often put their foolish favorites into office over those more qualified. Fools in high places. The other thing that will be difficult sometimes, he says, watch out for fools in action. Every situation, your notes say, every situation has its risks, but the fool doesn't notice it. Verse 8 through 10. He that diggeth a pit shall fall into it. If you send a fool out to dig a pit, he's going to fall right into the same pit he's digging. And whoso breaketh an hedge, a serpent shall bite him. If you send him out to break down this stone hedge, he won't even see the serpent. He'll get bit by a serpent. Verse 9, whosoever removeth the stone shall be hurt therewith. You know, there's some people, they seem to be accident prone. That's what he's talking about. I'm not saying they're necessarily fools, but they're oftentimes not looking at what's going on. And he that cleaveth wood shall be endangered thereby. He says, if the iron be blunt and he do not whet the edge, then must he put to more strength, but wisdom is profitable to direct. That was a very convicting verse to me as a father. Because what that says is if you're trying to get a job done and you find yourself always having to use more force to do it, and I'm thinking about the way I have to deal with my children to get them to obey. If you're finding yourself having to use more and more and more force with your children, probably you're dealing with a dull act. And I'm not talking about them, I'm talking about me. Take some time to sharpen your axe. And it won't take so much effort. In other words, become wise. He's just listening here. All kinds of behavior that is true of fools who don't handle life wisely. Fools in conversation and competence. Verses 11 and 19. Surely the serpent will bite without enchantment, and a babbler is no better. Point A in your notes, say, a man unskillfully using words, a babbler is as dangerous as an unskilled snake charmer. Well, wouldn't you just like to be around that guy? Verse 12, the words of a wise man's mouth are gracious, but the lips of a fool will swallow up himself. The beginning of the words of, verse 13, the beginning of the words of his mouth is foolishness, and the end of his talk is mischievous madness. Your notes say there, point B, a fool starts with himself and ends up in a dangerous rage. Point C, he is totally unpredictable. Verse 14 says, a fool also is full of words. Man cannot tell what shall be. He's unpredictable. And what shall be after him? Who can tell him? Verse 15, point D in your notes say, his moral and spiritual sloth wears on everyone and makes him totally incompetent, even in everyday matters. Verse 15, the labor of the foolish wearieth every one of them because he knoweth not how to go to the city. You can give him an errand to go to the city, and he just frustrates you again and again and again. Wears you out. Verse 16, woe to thee, O land, when thy king is a child and thy princes eat in the morning. indulgent. Verse 17, blessed art thou, O land, when thy king is the son of the nobles, and thy princes eat in due season for strength and not for drunkenness. Verse 18, by much slothfulness the building decayeth, and through idleness of the hands the house droppeth through. First point E in your notes, say the results of his sloth are seen in the disintegration around him of everything truly important. This was a very convicting verse to me as a father too when the children were young. By much slothfulness the building decayeth, and through idleness of the hands the house droppeth through. You know, if you buy a house, you buy a project. It's got to be repainted, and it's got to be recarpeted, it's got to be re-something, all because of the fall. Stuff just degenerates. Unless you labor against the fall. And I got thinking about that one day when I was applying this to the house, my home, I don't mean the physical home, but the home of people. That because they have natures that degenerate, I've got to always be on guard fixing the stuff at its earliest leak. Or the whole thing will degenerate. And I tell you, this verse, God convicted me about this when shortly after Kirsten was born, that if I don't stay on top of what's going on in her life, this house will fall through. I've got to be one active dad in her life, or the house is going to drop through. Winding up here, he talks a little bit about fools in private in verse 20. Curse not the king, not even in your thoughts. And curse not the rich in thy bedchamber, for a bird of the air shall carry thy voice, and that which hath wings shall tell the matter. I think this is where that thing a little birdie told me. I think that's where that phrase probably came from. Point five in your notes, the section closes with a practical word of advice. Neither the king nor the leadership of a nation or the rich must give rise to foolish anger in the wise man's life. The verse challenges us to remain calm in days of national sloth, immaturity, indulgence, and calls for a submissive approach to authority, giving an expedient reason for obedience. The walls have ears. We should take our life day by day from the hand of a sovereign God. Now, this looks again like a pop bead section, but he's just coming and hammering away just real practical truths and saying, look, life has enough fluctuations. Don't be a fool in your response. Handle this wisely. Conclusion is that life is full of intentional mystery to goad us to dependence. The secret to persevering in life is to live wisely, not foolishly. A fool can't even find his way into town, let alone his way in life. A fool doesn't see the dangers of his actions. A fool, if he's a king, doesn't even know who to put in power with him. A fool doesn't sharpen his axe, he just hits harder. A fool parties when disappointments hit. He doesn't stop and think. And the appeal to us is to recognize the foolishness in our own lives so we can persevere wisely in all of these fluctuations. And to be dissatisfied amidst mystery points you the way down. Puts you on the path of the way down. Have all of this mystery, all these unsolved mysteries. Why is God like this? Why is my husband like that? Why is our circumstances like this? Why is death like this, so unpredictable, all these things? Well, if that makes you dissatisfied, you will begin your path down. Dissatisfaction and then to anxiety and to despair. In the next session, we're going to pick up another theme of how to persevere amidst all of this. The first thing he says is persevere wisely. He's going to give us two more ways to persevere before he finishes this. Now, again, we may say, well, you know, some of this stuff I've heard before, this is just kind of disconnected. Look, folks, this is how God inspired it and gave it to us. That means there is something here for us, even though it seems disjointed and pop bead together, and we've got to take the time to, you know how you get wise? Before we leave, let's turn over to Proverbs 2. Well, we get wisdom by just praying for it. Doesn't James 1:5 say, if any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God, and he giveth to all men liberally, and abradeth none, and it shall be given him. Folks, that's fire extinguisher wisdom.
That's wisdom in an emergency. This is what a student gets to pray when he is ready to take a test if he has studied. And he can send up a prayer to God and say, God, help me remember all that stuff I've diligently studied. And God will give him wisdom in that trial. But God will not bring answers to your mind that have never crossed your mind before. That is not the normal way to get wisdom. That's the way to get a reminder from God of wisdom when you're in a trial. That's the whole point of James 1 about trials. The normal way to get wisdom is Proverbs 2. My son, if thou wilt receive my words, there is a reception I have to have in my heart, and hide my commandments with thee. Treasure them. Incline thine ear unto wisdom, and apply thine heart to understanding. Yea, if thou criest after knowledge, and liftest up thy voice for understanding, if thou seekest her as silver, and searchest for her as for hid treasure, then shalt thou understand the fear of the Lord, and find the knowledge of God. For the Lord giveth wisdom, out of his mouth cometh knowledge and understanding. He layeth up, he's got it all stored up to give to the righteous. He is a buckler to them that walk uprightly. How do you get wisdom? You dig for it in this book. And he's not playing hide and seek where he's saying, ha 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 ha, you can't ever find it. But just like you don't spill your guts, if I can use that, you don't spill your guts to just the casual passerby, neither does God. You have to demonstrate diligent dependence on him, and he will open this book to you. And that's true of and that's true of the books of Proverbs and of Ecclesiastes. This is not an easy book to understand. But if you will take the time to diligently search it out, it will, as I said, the time that I don't know how many hours I spent in this book working on this thing the first time through, I just, you know, dozens and dozens. And I've told you, it had the most profound impact on my life of any other study I've ever done in my life. Because I walked away from it fully convinced. I really need God. Now, I'm not saying I'm not tempted to do stuff on my own, but boy, God pulls my chain real quick. Says, remember those mysteries? Remember those goads? I mean, I recognize goads all the time now. That's not bad. But you don't get that by just a casual brush of this. You search for it. You receive it. You incline your ear. You go after it as you were looking for treasure, because that's what it is. Well, let's pray. Lord Jesus, help us to search and to receive and to carve out the time from all of our other foolish activities, to spend this kind of time with you where you, the living God, can speak to us and make us wise. Help us. We are so foolish on our own. All of us want to go our own way. And I pray that you would help us. Continue to teach us in this time. We pray in your name.